So, do we notice any sex difference between the people present and the people missing?
It's a Friday.
Here they come. Anyone hungry?
Yes.
Go get it.
Are you serious? I don't know. This is a Friday.
No, there's three boxes of pizza in 104.
But you have to be cautious about finding food in the science.
There's nothing in here.
Not that one. That one's empty. But there are three full ones in 104, and there's a microwave. Why?
Yeah.
It's left over from yesterday, and we don't want it to sit in the refrigerator.
It's been there since yesterday?
It's been in the refrigerator since yesterday. I ate some, and I'm alive. If I throw up during class, you'll know you will soon be in that same situation. Questions? Is that the syringe problem?
Yes. No, the one after that.
Breathing
in. Good.
It's good.
It says that the flow rate is doubled.
What?
That is the freezing one.
This
one's
the last piece.
So there are two unopened boxes in the refrigerator, two full complete pizzas in the refrigerator. And there's one that's sitting out to entice you to have more.
Well, that one's not sitting out. It's like the last of it.
Okay. So your question was about which one?
The one where you breathe in and the...
Well, thanks.
Oh.
Pizza's delicious.
So they give you the strain velocity, flow rate doubles. And you got to find out...
And
I was just working on it.
You have to find the pressure change.
Anybody, so I remember roughly the problem. Anyone remember what number it is? I can go over here and find it. So you're saying it's the last one on the WebAssign? So it might be number 48. Yes, person inhales, air moves through the bronchial tubes, 15 centimeters a second. Average flow speed of the air doubles through a constriction. Assuming incompressible flow, determine the pressure drop. So that one's pretty easy, right? Because that's just Bernoulli. Right? If we know, so it's we can ignore these terms. Basically because the density of air is small and there's not a big height difference. So we know that the velocity changes by a factor of 2, so we can kind of immediately figure out the pressure difference.
The airflow changes by a factor.
Does it say airflow or no, it says velocity, doesn't it?
The airflow speed.
Average flow speed doubles.
Yes.
Airflow speed velocity.
That's what V is.
Oh, I calculated that.
Other people think they're okay on this problem, 48.
I think the syringe one was the real thing. Yeah. So when you're doing change in pressure for the syringe
problem. So hold off for a second. Other syringe problem is, I think, the next one.
The previous one in the book.
Yeah. So for the syringe problem, you would be happy, you should be happy, if they told you the cross-sectional area of the syringe. They only give us the big part.
Right. So then how do you figure it out?
Yeah, so, but I'm saying, if you knew the little part, would you be happy?
Right.
Yeah.
They give it to me.
They don't give it to us. Nope, they don't give it to us.
The area of the little part?
No, they only give us the area of the big part.
Oh, they gave me the area of the little part.
No, they didn't.
I got it right.
So, The upshot is, if you remember what we did in class, we had cases where the radius went down by a factor of 2.
Yeah.
In which case this term was a 16th. And we had cases where in the squirt gun where it went down by a factor of 10, in which case this was a 10,000th. And for a needle, it's going to be even smaller. That is to say, the ratio of the needle cross-section to the plunger cross-section is going to be, for all intents and purposes, zero, or at least very, very, very small. So we can neglect that term.
How would you know to do
that? Well, there's no needle that's so fat that it would be comparable in size to the barrel.
Oh, so I calculated it thinking that they gave me the area of the little part of the needle and it didn't really matter anything.
Yeah, so if you did it without neglecting this term, then you'll get the right answer.
So then that whole term would be zero.
Would be, so it's one,
yes.
Minus zero, which is just one.
Yes. So the upshot is that the area in this problem is so small in comparison to the original area that it's negligible. And as I say, just for the squirt gun, which has a much bigger hole than the typical needle, this term was a 10,000th.
Now, how did you figure that out?
Because there they told us what the ratio of the radiuses are.
If it isn't obviously zero, it'll give you a second area.
So this is the general formula.
Right.
And I guess if I were going to give you a problem, I would probably give you those areas so that you're not confused. But you can see, I hope, that it's a totally legitimate approximation that this term is nothing in comparison to one for a real needle.
Are there any densities and constants new that you're going to want us to memorize, or will we typically have a table?
No. So I will not expect you to have memorized the density of water, which is 1,000. So I would give you that.
Okay. So we could just.
And I will. Yeah, I think I would give you atmospheric pressure. I mean, you should.
It's just sometimes in the websites and the book problems they don't give, and then you have to go back.
Yes. And so that's kind of a new thing. I don't remember previous problems where they've had us looking back so much, at least. But that's kind of what these problems are like, right? Fluid properties are tabulated in places like the CRC, and so very commonly, or Wiki for that matter, very commonly you want to get in the habit of looking those things up. But for an exam, if you look on the class guide, I have constants to know. And as far as I remember, I'm pretty sure the only constant to know so far through this class is 9.8 meters per second squared. I think eventually something else gets added to that, but.
So how do you find the change in pressure?
For the syringe problem?
Would you do force divided by area for the force and then minus one?
No. So first of all, you couldn't do minus one because they would have different units. So for the syringe, we know it's atmospheric pressure out here, and it's mostly atmospheric pressure here too, except we're also applying a force. So the pressure out here, let me call that P1, is going to be the force per area plus atmospheric pressure. And of course, P2 is atmospheric pressure. So when I do the subtraction, the change in pressure is just the force per area that I'm applying to the syringe. Why do they still tell you it's what?
They say the pressure in the needle is equal to 1.
They say 1 times 10 to the 5th, which is what atmospheric pressure is.
Oh, 1 atmosphere is what they say.
Okay.
Or do they say 1 atmosphere? Yeah. Okay.
But same thing.
Same thing, yeah.
So then, in order to find the velocity, which that question was asking for, can't you just use the Bernoulli-Daddy equation, and then you input, when you get it down, simplify it down, to finding V2 squared, can't you just input using the continuity,
So we're still talking about the syringe problem, right?
Yeah.
So that's exactly how this equation was derived in class,
yeah.
Right? All we did is we said that they are the same altitude and that V1 had this relationship to V2.
Okay.
And then put things on opposite sides of the equation, and that's the source of that equation. So this isn't, kind of a memorable equation. I don't know if I would bother to write it on my cheat sheet. It should be pretty quickly derivable from those guys. More questions? Good enough? Okay, so everyone liked the I quiz so much last time that we might as well do more of it. Yeah, so I'm not going to talk about it. So I was convinced, I think, incorrectly to cancel the quiz based on the chem exam. But there were complaints in the earlier class. They wanted that quiz.
There was one complaint. I'm pretty sure it came
from. There was more than one. But, yeah, so I wanted you to at least see that quiz because I think they help you study for the exam. So I didn't want to totally cancel it, but... I was convinced by you, by this class, to cancel it. More questions? So I'll probably do a screencast with the answer. But I really want you to kind of think of that yourself. That's one of the benefits of this quiz. It's a chance to do a problem without the red X or the green check. More questions?
Why does green make us feel so good? Yeah, you're done with the problem.
Because you've been told your whole life that red is bad.
Means go.
Yeah. It means money.
Does it mean money?
Money.
No. Okay, it means iQuiz time.
Would that make people depressed? Okay, sorry.
So we've got this floating plastic ball. It has some volume V and some mass M and some density. Rho P, and its density of water is rho W, and we're supposed to tell me what the formula is for the buoyant force on the ball.
Oh, I quiz.
You did so well on them last time that. I like this class. Well, not everyone in the class. So the purpose of the question is to suck you in for B, right? Because that looks a whole lot like the equation for the buoyant force. But the V is not the volume of the object, it's the volume that's displaced, which is clearly less than the volume of the object if it's floating. But we do know that the buoyant force has to be countering the force of gravity. So the buoyant force better equal mg. And if you like A, it's exactly the same as C, right? Because the density times the volume is going to give you the mass. So two-handed AC is the best possible answer. So now I'm going to hold it underwater. What's the buoyant force on it? I'm not telling. Volume is the volume of the object. I'm not fooling anyone so far. Yeah. So this is the counterexample to it's always the wrong answer, right? So yeah. So now it is V is the volume displaced. So we're into B. So we've got an ice cube that's currently solid and it's floating in a glass of water. As the ice cube melts, of course, it's going to become water. Does the water level as a whole rise or fall when this happens? There's a qualitative, do you get answers from the previous class? Ah, I fooled some people in the back row. So what is certainly true is when the ice cube melts, it's going to take up less volume, right? Because ice expands when it freezes. And in fact, it'll exactly fill the spot that is filled with water. And we know that, of course, because the mass doesn't change. And the weight of that ice cube is exactly equal to the weight that is displaced, right? And the weight that is displaced is the part, you know, that's underwater. So this ice cube will melt and exactly fill in the spot that is currently underwater.
But it expands when it's ice, and that's why a little bit of it is above water.
Yeah.
So it's just
So it stays the same.
So theoretically, if you have a piece of ice floating in some water, you can measure what's sticking out of the water, and then you'll know how much that ice expanded.
Yes. Yep. So, I mean, typically people say that 90% is under the underwater, and so we have the density of ice being 0.9 times the.
So, just curious, real world connection here. So, why is global warming a problem?
So, no one's worried about the floating ice melting. That won't do anything. The floating ice melting will not raise sea level. But there's a lot of ice, like on Greenland, that when it melts, it flows into the ocean and it raises the level just fine. Okay, so two identical glasses of water. A must have more water in it because it has exactly the same level as B. And in the case of B, some of what's water in A is plastic. So these two things, identical water level, which one would weigh more if I were to put it on a balance? So B must have less water, but it's got more plastic. Does it weigh more or less than A? I don't fool as many people in this class as I do in the other class. So the weight of the plastic is exactly equal to the weight of the water that's displaced, right? Because it's supporting it. So the missing water here is exactly equal to the weight of the plastic, so they weigh exactly the same. See?
But they have the same amount of water.
They don't have the same amount of water, right? It says B has less total water since the level is the same. It's the level that's the same. Questions? Okay. So, 2 times ago we had a boatload of equations, and last time we just have these 2 equations. So these are equations that deal with so-called incompressible fluids. Now, it turns out that there is no such thing as an absolutely incompressible fluid, right? You worked a homework problem that said that water will compress a little bit if you subject it to absolutely tremendous forces. But generally speaking, under normal sorts of conditions, you can treat air and water as incompressible fluids as long as the air is moving much less than the speed of sound. And then you can apply these equations. Incidentally, if you wanted to deal with compressible fluids, it turns out you don't have to make a big change. You remember enthalpy from chemistry. Basically, you just use enthalpy instead of pressure, and you're good to go for compressible fluids also. And the equations on the bottom row are just recalling things that we did 2 classes ago.
I thought you said airs could we consider compressible?
As long as the speeds that are involved are less than the speed of sound, the air isn't compressed noticeably.
But don't we have like thousands of air compressors?
Air is certainly compressible, yes. So if you put it in a piston and push down on it, you can compress it just fine.
Yeah. But you're not moving it at the speed of sound with a piston, are
you? You are compressing it the consistent amount, yes. You can do it slowly too. But in terms of this equation, if these velocities are small compared to the speed of sound, you're good to go. And incidentally, another way of saying it is that if this term is small in comparison to that term, you're good to go. More questions? Well, in the next section, we also have a boatload of equations. But it's kind of funny, if you look at the chapter review, none of those equations make it to the back of the book. Some of them are nice boxed equations, so they're, I think, moderately important. But they're not fundamental equations. They all have to do with kind of particular situations. And in particular, they have to do with situations in which we have less than ideal fluids. And probably the first way that fluids are less than perfectly ideal and don't exactly satisfy the Bernoulli equation is if there is friction present. You might remember that I said that we derive this equation by using conservation of energy, which requires no non-conservative forces, and friction is a non-conservative force. So the name for friction that occurs in fluids is viscosity. And to the extent that viscosity is important, we're going to have violations of the Bernoulli equation. So first of all, qualitatively, viscosity kind of has to do with the fluidness of the stuff. So this is water that has colorant in it. And you can see it moves around pretty easily. Here we've got glycerin. Things are moving, you know, maybe not quite so well. And here's mazola oil. It's clearly a lot different. So honey, of course, would be another step up. So viscosity is this property that has to do with the flowability of the fluid. And so this, you might know that oil has even less density than water, but you can see it's not flowing nearly as well as the water is. So viscosity is something distinct from density. So what is exactly viscosity? Well, we have friction when we have surfaces that are rubbing on each other. And in the same sort of sense, we're going to have fluid friction if we have layers of fluid that are moving at different speeds. So kind of in essence, they're rubbing against each other. If we look at the force on a sheet like this, it's going to be pulled along in this direction. And that force, we can calculate, it depends on this area of this sheet, and it depends on how fast the velocity is changing with altitude. So the change in velocity with change in, say, altitude. So this quantity is sometimes called the velocity gradient. And there's a fudge factor. Greek letter eta is what our book used, and that's what the viscosity is. So viscosity is a relationship between how the velocity changes and the corresponding frictional force. Okay.
Is that multiple, like to get viscosity, that's multiplying those
three? Yes, you multiply those three numbers together. That'll give you the corresponding force. So one place where we see viscosity kind of in action is if we think about falling objects. So right now, if I take this object and let it fall, it accelerates. But if I had a tall enough building, this thing would reach a terminal velocity where the drag force of the air would equal the weight of the object. So what is the drag force that exists because of this sort of friction? Well, Stokes is the guy who figured this out. So this is called Stokes' law, and the drag force, kind of the important thing is it depends linearly on velocity. And then there are some factors out front that include the viscosity and the radius of the object. So that's 6 pi eta times r. V. Velocity. So this is the drag force is equal to 6 pi viscosity, radius of the particle, times the velocity. Now, in fact, the viscosity of air is pretty small. And if we, instead of making this thing fall, if we shoot the air up, we can reach a similar equilibrium that's kind of just the static version of it. We did this last time. So this doesn't have so much to do with viscosity. It has to do with what's called dynamic pressure. So if I were to kind of show the flow lines of around this ball, so I would have a flow line that is kind of going like this, and a flow line that's going kind of like this, and there would be one flow line that would be coming to rest right at the middle of the ball. So this is called a stagnation point. And because the velocity has gone from some high speed to zero, according to Bernoulli's equation, there's going to be an extra high pressure at the stagnation point that is going to be 1/2 the density of the fluid times the speed of the fluid squared. And so overall, there's going to be some drag force, right? Pressure is force per area. So the drag force on this thing is going to be that pressure times the cross-sectional area of my object, which is going to be 1/2 rho v squared times the area. Now, in fact, I mean, not all of this fluid is going to come to rest, so we kind of don't need the whole area. So we insert kind of a fudge factor that's called the drag coefficient in order to make a reasonably correct equation for the drag force.
Okay, so the equation you just wrote, 1/2, is that a P or a,
rho. This is a P, pressure. And this is a rho. So I guess I'm not sure how far over. So this really is the same one as this one.
Okay.
I didn't do anything different. The equation that you might have been asking is, how do I know which one of these two equations to use, since they're both giving us drag force? That one too, huh? So it's called the drag coefficient. It's just a fudge factor. So we calculated kind of what the force would be if the pressure difference that occurs here occurred every place. But obviously not all of this air is going to come to rest, so the pressure difference is going to be less here and even less there. So we can actually do that sort of calculation and numerically come up with the drag coefficient, but practically speaking, they are experimentally determined. So when car companies want to figure out what the drag force is on their car, they use this equation and they figure out what the force is in a wind tunnel, and then they can calculate the drag coefficient of their car. And you'll find those things tabulated in places where they rate cars, right? The smaller the drag coefficient, the slipperier the car is, and the less drag you're going to get, the higher fuel efficiency you're going to get. Okay, so if we kind of relate these two equations, this one goes quadratically with velocity. So it has to look kind of like that in a plot of drag force versus velocity. This one goes linearly with velocity, so it goes like that. Now, the exact relationships that are going to be involved kind of don't matter. It has to be the case that at sufficiently small velocities, this one is less than that one. And it must be at high enough speeds that the quadratic is going to beat the linear. So there's some kind of magic crossing point where these two forces are equally present. And if we look at the ratio of those forces, so this thing is sometimes called the inertial force, dynamic pressure force. So I'm just looking at the ratio of these two to the Stokes' law. Just to figure out kind of which one is most important. So the dynamic pressure, that's going to be 1/2 rho v squared times the area, which I might as well just call r squared, roughly speaking. Whereas the drag force is going to be 6 pi times the viscosity times radius and the velocity. So if I just kind of squint and close my eyes, the velocity is going to cancel out. One of these radiuses are going to cancel out, and I'm going to get the density times the velocity times 1 power of radius divided by the viscosity. And this quantity is called the Reynolds number. And it gives us a handle on which force is going to be most prominent, viscous forces or pressure drag forces, dynamic forces. And we've thought about this in terms of falling objects, but this would apply to lots of similar situations. So for example, if I have fluid that's flowing through a pipe, if the fluid is flowing fast enough, then it turns out that the dynamic forces are going to be larger than the viscous forces. Whereas if things are going slow enough, then what's going to happen is there's going to be a noticeable amount of friction from these walls, and instead of the velocity profile being the same every place, the fluid is going to be moving faster at the center of the pipe than it's going to be moving at the edges of the pipe. Okay, so if the viscous forces are the most important result, and we have this sort of situation where the material is flowing fastest at the center, it turns out we can calculate what the flow rate is. So the total flow rate, obviously it's mostly in the center, in cubic meters per second, you can calculate with one of those equations that's in the book, pi times the radius to the fourth times the pressure difference between the ends of the pipe divided by the viscosity and the length. And I think there's an 8 there. Yep. So this is called Percival's law. So it gives us the flow rate that you're going to have if viscous forces are the primary constituent, if we have relatively slow flow. So this is also called laminar flow.
Did you say the bottom denominator was the viscous or the viscosity?
So this is 8 times the viscosity times the length of the pipe.
Oh, that's an 8. I thought that was like a row. And I'm like, where did that come from?
No row.
8
times the viscosity times the length of the pipe is what's in the denominator. In the numerator, we've got pi times the radius of the pipe to the fourth times the pressure difference between the ends of the pipe.
Big R is the radius of the pipe.
Big R is the radius of the pipe.
What was that called?
Percival's law. So it's, you know, it's a named law, but it's not a fundamental law like F equals ma. It depends on the particulars, right? A circular pipe that where viscous pressure, where viscous forces are prominent. And it is a boxed equation in our book. It's not particularly memorable to me. It is very important where we have fluids that are flowing at low speed through pipes, like veins, right? So it has a great deal of biological application. If we have faster velocities...
Sorry, you can continue.
No, nope, I'm not.
Okay, I was just wondering about the Reynolds thing.
Yes.
How did the numbers equal, or the half to over the g, is that g pi?
So that's 6 pi.
6 pi, okay.
So there are all sorts of those numbers, and I'm just, they don't cancel out. You can see that they don't, but I'm just ignoring them.
Oh, don't worry,
okay.
What?
So yep. So I'm defining Reynolds number to be this quantity, which is not exactly equal to the ratio of the dynamic drag force to the Stokes' law force, but it's more or less the same.
Hence why you said squint your eyes.
Say again?
Hence why you said squint your eyes and it'll work.
Yes.
So is that 6 pi as well, not g pi on the Stokes?
So this is 6 pi.
And then the one below it is also 6 pi?
Yes. Same thing, right? This formula is that formula.
And one half.
So the plan is maybe so there's some constant, right? 1/12 pi, I could multiply Reynolds number by if I wanted to. But the plan is kind of the reverse of what you're saying. The idea is we're going to tabulate in the CRC that if the Reynolds number is, you know, more than 1,000, then the flow is going to be turbulent. And so if in the end we're going to tabulate this as a numerical value, there's no real reason to divide it by some constants. It's easier to pull everything out like that. Well, so it's even worse than maybe what I'm saying is this is, so the book talks about the Reynolds number, but the exact situation, what is the radius? What do you mean by the radius of, you know, a falling pig, for example? A pig, yeah. They fly, so they must fall. So these things are all kind of a little bit of qualitative, and for the book, what they're mostly concerned in is flow through pipes. And so what they are going to define as the Reynolds number is where we put in the diameter of the pipe, basically because that's a lot easier to measure. So they're going to declare that that's the Reynolds number for flow through pipes, and then we can tabulate what the flow will be as a function of that Reynolds number. And they could, if they wanted to, tabulate it divided by 12 pi, but why bother? Yeah, so the separation between turbulent and non-turbulent depends on the exact physical situation and exactly what you've defined your Reynolds number to be. But in the case of pipes, with their definition of diameter, roughly speaking, the separation between smooth laminar flow and turbulent flow is a Reynolds number of say, a couple of thousand. And obviously, that's not a firm number. It's going to depend on how rough the pipe is and how intermittent the flow is. But there's a big difference in the flow. If we have high Reynolds number flow, it won't be steady. There'll be things like eddies that are colliding with the wall of the pipe. So we'll have time-dependent flow, and we will have velocities that are much more uniform than they are in the viscous flow situation. So kind of a rough separation between turbulent flow and laminar flow is based on Reynolds number. And what Reynolds number and what the value is that separates, those are going to depend on the geometry of the situation.
And then, so the flow rate, that's the equation for the flow rate?
So this was, and this was in the case of laminar flow.
Okay, and then, so what's the relationship between that and then the Reynolds number?
Well, there isn't a direct relationship. Okay. So the only time you should apply this formula is if the Reynolds number is substantially less than 2,000.
Okay.
Then we have laminar flow and this equation applies. If we're in turbulent flow, then basically you have to look up in engineering books about what the flow is turbulently through a pipe. So, I mean, there are lots of ways you can run the problem. One homework problem, I think, says, here are the situations for the aorta. Is it turbulent or is it laminar?
Okay,
so you calculate the Reynolds number and see whether it's more than 2,000 or not.
Wait, so how much less than 2,000 should be?
Well, I think in that problem it comes out to be like 4,000. So these things don't have smooth distinctions. Well, I don't know if I want to say that or not.
Don't use that formula unless it's much less than 2,000, I think you said.
Yeah, that's what I said.
So,
but maybe I should have just said noticeably less.
So how much is that, like 500?
Well, so it depends. And in particular, it depends a whole lot on how smooth this pipe is.
Okay.
You can't buy perfectly smooth pipes. In some theoretical sense, if the pipe were perfectly smooth and everything were perfectly arranged, the flow would never go turbulent. So in cases where they're using this equation, I think they say assume the flow is laminar, which means assume that you're using that flow, that equation.
Okay.
And there are other problems that say calculate the Reynolds number and declare whether the flow is turbulent or laminar.
So then if it happens, if you use the Reynolds number and it happens to be greater than the 2,000, do we have to do a next step like compared to that, the flow rate?
So we don't have formulas in this book to calculate the flow rate for turbulent motion.
Okay.
So you can look in engineering books. So typically so it turns out that for the aorta, which is kind of the worst case, right? The velocities are high and we have fat pipes. Turns out in that case the flow is turbulent, but most of the blood flow through your body is laminar.
Okay.
So that's why they haven't bothered to spend a lot of time on turbulent flow. That's for the radius.
Right, on this side.
Yes.
On this side.
The only place that I wrote Reynolds number is here, and I never used an R for it.
Okay.
Every R is radius on the board.
Okay.
Except the R of Reynolds.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
More than 2,000.
You go ask an engineer.
Okay. All right.
It's not that hard, but the most flow inside bodies is laminar. So the book hasn't bothered to talk about turbulent flow. So most natural flows outside of bodies are turbulent. And most flows in chemical processing is turbulent. So that's why engineers are highly concerned about turbulent flow. Laminar flow in engineering senses is relatively rare.
So if it's more than 2,000, then it's turbulent?
Say again?
If it's more than 2,000, then it's turbulent?
Yes. Approximately speaking,
it's turbulent.
Okay, so there are two things that I want to say. Large Reynolds number is turbulent, and the exact boundary isn't something that, there probably is a number in the book, but in fact, it's not something you can write down. It depends on the exact nature of the tube. If the tube were exactly symmetrical, and if the flow started out exactly symmetrical, then theoretically, it would remain laminar all the way through.
And when it would be laminar, it would all be flowing like smoothly, the turbulent would be when it's flowing slower on the sides than it is in the middle.
No. No, so laminar is where it is going at zero velocity on the wall and highest velocity in the center. Turbulent is where the velocity depends on time. So at one point in space, there isn't a constant velocity. Sometimes it's fast, sometimes it's slow, as little eddies go by. So with laminar flow, if you were to measure the velocity here now and in a year, you'd get exactly the same number. With turbulent flow, if you measure the velocity there, it's changing. Every second, you get a different value.
Okay. Oh, that makes sense.
So this distinction between turbulent and laminar, it's a non-trivial problem. You can get $1 million if you can answer the problem. So you've probably heard of the Nobel Prizes. There are Clay Millennial Prizes, which are worth $1 million. And one of those prizes is to solve exactly how you get this transition between laminar and turbulent flow. People have been working on it for a couple of centuries. It's not an easy problem. It's not a hard problem in engineering senses. That is to say, you can measure what the flow is through pipes and you can tabulate it in books. But mathematically, exactly how that transition occurs is tough. And it depends on all sorts of funny situations.
So if it's less than 2,000, you need to ask an engineer whether or not it might be laminar, right?
So if it's small, it's going to be laminar. If it's big, it's going to be turbulent.
Okay.
Exactly where the transition occurs, up for grabs, on the order of thousands, though. So if you calculate a Reynolds number and it's 10, it's laminar. If you calculate a Reynolds number and it's 1,999.9, it could be either one.
That's a laminar.
And the flow rate that you get under laminar situation is in that circle.
What about for turbulent?
Then you have to ask an engineer.
Okay, so then I don't know if you had told us, but what is the relationship between the Stokes equation and then the other drag?
So it's an analogous sort of situation. That is to say, if we have this sort of situation, maybe I drew this in a simple way, but if you were to look at the flow behind this thing, it would be turbulent. If you were to look at the flow around something that is following Stokes' law, it would be steady. It would look kind of like that.
So more laminar type for Stokes?
So laminar. Stokes has to do with forces that are just based on viscosity. And this drag law has to do with the case where inertial forces are large. So the distinction between this force law and that force law is similar to the distinction between turbulent and laminar. So one of the things that's different is I got an equation here, right? I got an equation here. No equation here. Equation with a fudge factor. So the turbulent cases are cases where we can't exactly mathematically calculate the results because no one has won the Millennial Prize. Even afterwards, you won't be able to calculate.
So So she's Stokes for laminar problems and then the other one for turbulent.
Yeah, I'll find that acceptable. But maybe a better way is to realize that Stokes applies to low velocities and the other one is going to apply to high velocities. But yeah, you could calculate the Reynolds number, and if it's big, you can use this law.
What would you consider a low velocity?
So that's an excellent question. So I will claim that you can't claim that anything is big or small if it has units. Because everything's relative. So how do you decide what's relative? You got to use something that's dimensionless, which is Reynolds number. We're back to Reynolds number. The Reynolds number is small. We can use viscous forces as being the most important one. The Reynolds number is big, then we've got to go ask an engineer.
So in other words, just pretend that we never came to class and just let engineers figure it out.
Well, but we do know a couple of things. We know when to talk to an engineer. And if we don't have to talk to an engineer, then we can solve the problem. Well, the engineers are really mostly dealing with the viscous motion. They may not.
They don't know how to do the equation.
Well, this is so simple, it's in the books. But it's not really relevant to designing vats, you know, which is what engineers do. That's all they do. They spend the entire day designing vats. More questions? Vats.
Can we start practice problems?
No. We haven't. We've got one more important factoid. So one regard, probably the most important regard, that ideal fluids are different from real fluids is viscosity, frictional force. Another way they're different is something that you all know. So we've said lots of times that if something has a density that's more than water, it's going to sink. Less than water, it's going to float. But I'm sure you've all seen steel needles floating on water, right? You haven't seen that? Try it at home. Steel needles, like needle and thread. If you're careful, you can float that on water.
What, really?
Really. You got to put them in flat. You can't just drop them in. You got to put them in the water carefully like that. They sink every time if you put them in like that. It's totally surface tension. Yeah. So the boundary of a ball of fluid is being held together exactly like a rubber. The rubber plastic is holding together the surface of a balloon. There's going to be a force, a tension, that is present at that surface. And this force is, technically speaking, it's a force per area. Or excuse me, a force per length. So for example, if I were to dip a rod into a fluid and bring up a film of fluid that's hanging below this rod, say, think about a soap film. So here's that soap film. Here's the rest of the fluid. There would be a force that is pulling down on this rod. And that force would equal this length of the fluid times a number that is called the surface tension. Now, I'm describing surface tension as a force per length, but I could also describe it as an energy per area. This is a gamma. There isn't a universally acceptable Greek letter for surface tension, but that's what our book is using. So we could talk about the energy per area, the energy that it takes to create more surface, and that would also be the surface tension. And that makes perfectly good sense because a newton per meter is exactly the same thing as a joule per square meter. Now, there's one thing that's a little bit tricky about this calculation that maybe I've lied a little bit about. if we have a sheet of fluid, it's got one side and it's got another side. So both of those sheets are going to contribute to the force that's pulling this thing down. Right? Here's a surface, there's a surface. Both of them would be pulling with this force. So actually the force would be twice that. Okay, so I'm sure you've all noticed that if you have, I don't know, a glob of mercury that's sitting on a table, it might look kind of like that. Whereas if you have a glob of water sitting on the table, it might look like that. That there are various contact angles that are present when surfaces are in contact. And this is totally just a matter of force equations. So you may not recognize it, but this is a fluid. Air is a perfectly good fluid. Water is, of course, a fluid. And here we have a solid. I don't know, let me give these things some names, 1, 2, and 3. So there will be some tension on this air glass interface that is pulling that interface that way. And there will be some tension on this surface that's pulling that thing that way. And there will be some force this way that's pulling it that way. And all that's involved here is force balance. So the forces in the x direction have to cancel. So this surface tension, which I might as well call gamma 2-1, that has to equal the total force that way, which is gamma 3-1 plus the cosine of theta times gamma 2-3.
What?
This is force balance, right? So this is a force. The x component of it is a cosine. It's at this boundary.
Okay, so the boundary, so like there's tension between the air and the liquid.
Yeah, so you may not think that there's a surface between the air and the glass, but there is. And there's a surface tension between the air and the glass. There's a surface tension between the water and the glass, and there's a surface tension between the water and the air. Three separate surface tensions, all pulling in different directions. If this boundary isn't moving, if we're in a static situation, then the force in the x direction has to add up to zero. So to get a situation like mercury, what we need to have is a very small value for that surface tension so that this thing and the component in that direction are pretty much opposite. If we want to have this sort of situation, then we want to have, for example, this one being a lot less than the other two, so that angle theta has to be correspondingly small. If we know the surface tensions, then we can calculate the corresponding contact angles that we're going to get. So a lot of this is, I think, familiar to you from looking at graduated cylinders, right? If you look at water in a graduated cylinder, it has that sort of shape. The contact angle between the glass and the water, that angle there, is some smallish angle, an angle that's less than 90 degrees, which is sometimes called the wetting situation. If you look at mercury in that same tube, it's going to look like that, with that same angle being more than 90 degrees.
But it'll be the same angle?
No, they're not the same angle. And
are they complementary angles?
So the angle depends on the materials that involved. So there's no particular relationship between what's going on in water and in mercury. And it turns out that the surface tension depends a whole lot on contaminants. So if you were to add some cleaning fluid, for example, to this water, the surface tension gets reduced and this angle gets smaller. So it's actually pretty hard to measure, particularly for water, which easily has part per million contamination. It's hard to measure what the surface tension is for pure water. Incidentally, we could work out the exact shape of this meniscus, but roughly speaking, the dimension involved here is the square root of the surface tension divided by g times the density of the fluid. Okay, so surface tension, the last thing in the book that I want to talk about has to do with diffusion. So if we have situations like inside a cell where the concentration is different from the concentrations on the outside of the cell, it must be that there are some pumps that are active in the cell that are pumping stuff in or out. Because naturally, things usually come to equilibrium with the same concentration in the same places. If we think about a beaker where we have, you know, sugar that is dense on the bottom but hasn't worked its way towards the top yet, it's not a well-stirred beaker of water, we have a concentration gradient. So this is just like velocity gradient was a change with altitude. Here we're going to have a change in the concentration of the sucrose with altitude. That's going to determine the number of, the net number, because some are going to come down, the net number of sucrose molecules that are going to be moving through that boundary. So if we look at the flux of sucrose, more on that in a second, it turns out that there's a fudge factor called the diffusion constant, which can be tabulated in places like the CRC, that gives you the flux of material given a concentration gradient. Now, what I mean by flux here is going to be the change in concentration per time, the number of moles per second, per cross-sectional area, where the magic number D is called the diffusion constant. And this law is named for the famous dead physicist Fick. So this is Fick's law. So some combination of diffusion and pumping is what's responsible for the gradients that exist in concentrations of materials and cells. And I take it you know all about how nerves work and how by opening up pores you can change the potential differences and have nerve propagation, all that sort of good stuff from concepts. Questions? So finally we get to the most interesting part. What's on the test, right? So I think this 69 is kind of the most interesting question, so let's take a look at it first. So this is a practical problem. We want to get 500 cc's of material into a patient in 30 minutes. And you know the way this is done is you hang a bag of your material and you have a needle that goes into the patient. The tube that leads to the needle is relatively wide, so most of the action is happening here right in the needle, the very thin needle. And if we know what the pressure difference is between two ends of the needle, we can figure out what the flow rate is. Or contrarywise, if we know that we want to get 500 cc's in half an hour, we can calculate the required radius of this needle. Okay? So what we've got is, I'll use Q for the flow rate. And remember, we wanted this in cubic meters per second. According to the law that's been erased, this was pi times the radius to the fourth times the pressure difference divided by 8 times the viscosity times the length of the needle. So in this circumstance, the pressure difference is totally caused by this height difference. We know that the pressure difference when you go down in a fluid is given by rho gh. We are told that it's not going to be exactly true, that the pressure in the vein that you're pumping into is atmospheric pressure, and of course there's atmospheric pressure on top of this bag. So the pressure difference is just this rho gh of the hanging bag of fluid. So we got the pressure difference. This problem tells us the length of the needle. It says we can look up the viscosity and assume that it's water. So there's a table in the book that gives us the viscosity of water. R is what we're trying to find, what radius needle to use. Now to get the flow rate, we have to do some unit conversion. Yes?
Is that P sub zero are you using through the bloodstream?
Or? Yes. So this is atmospheric pressure. Okay. The problem says assume, contrary to fact, that the pressure of the flowing vein that you pumped, that you're that you've punctured to is atmospheric pressure.
That's what I thought.
Okay, so this flow rate, we've got 500 cubic centimeters that we want to get in 30 minutes.
Wait, how do we know the?
How do we know the? Oh, the eta?
The eta.
We can look that up in a book. So eta is the viscosity. And there's a table in the book. It says we can assume that it's water. Incidentally, the viscosity is the sort of thing you would find tabulated in your CRC. It does depend on temperature. So like the viscosity of water varies like a factor of 3 between room temperature and the boiling point of water. And I'm pretty sure we're supposed to use room temperature, but in fact, right, this needle is going to be at 37°C. So should probably actually use a, I think it's a smaller value of eta. Okay, so we know that in 1 meter, there are 100 centimeters, and we need to cube that because we've got cubic centimeters. And we know that in 1 minute, contrary to what lots of you write on exams, there are 60 seconds. As long as 3,600 seconds. People mistake hours for minutes. It's because they enjoy my lectures so much, they seem like they're just a minute long. That's what I assume. Okay, so we know the pressure difference, that's the rho GH. We know eta, we look it up in the table. We know the length of the needle, it's 2.5 centimeters. We've now converted our flow rate. So I'm not sure I'll do it, but we could just crank this through and get what the fourth power of R is. And of course, if I know what the fourth value of R is, I just need to take the square root of it twice to get what R is. So when you go down, the pressure gets more, right?
You would plug in a negative.
No, I would plug in a positive.
Oh.
The pressure gets more when you go down.
Okay.
So that's why the fluid is forced in, because the pressure is higher here than it is there.
In that case, we'd be finding the change in pressure, right?
We want the change in pressure. Everyone has atmospheric pressure. This guy has this extra pressure.
Okay.
Well, let's take a look at this question here. So this question deals with viscosity directly, and it assumes that we have two microscope slides, and we've put a millimeter and a half of glycerin between them, and we're asking how slippery is it? How hard are they to pull apart? So the formula for the force is we want the area, we want the viscosity, and we want the change in velocity with altitude. So the area we're talking about is this whole area that is moving for this whole microscope slide. So this is an area that is 1 centimeter by 4 centimeters. The change in velocity, the bottom slide, say, isn't moving. The top slide is moving at, somehow I think it's 0.3 meters a second. And the change in altitude is 1.5 millimeters. Now, we could convert everything to...
Is that 0.3 meters per second or 3?
0.3 meters a second.
Okay.
We could convert everything to MKS system, but in fact, pretty commonly when people are dealing with viscosity, they're going to use gram centimeters per second system. So the unit for viscosity in the unit of, so the units of viscosity in general, I hope you can see, are force times time divided by length squared. So usually this would be newtons seconds per meter squared. The unit for, and of course a newton is a kilogram meter per second. If we use the CGS system, then we're going to have a force that is a gram centimeter per second squared. And that's called a dyne. So we can look up the viscosity of glycerin in dyne seconds per centimeter squared, and it's about 15. So then what we're going to have for this force is 1 times 4 times 15 times 30 centimeters per second divided by 0.15 centimeters. And we're going to get out our force that's in dynes. And we can convert that to newtons if we want. So we've got 1 times 4 I can do in my head. So we got 4 times 15 times 30 divided by 0.15. And this is 1.2 times 10 to the fourth dynes. If we convert that to newtons, dyne is a pretty small force. This is 0.12 newtons. So in terms of these other problems, this is a surface tension problem. Remember that there are two sides to the surface. So the surface tension is going to involve twice the circumference of this ring that's being raised. So here we have a straightforward pipe sort of problem. So this is an exact application of Percival's law. And we did this one. Here's this problem where we're trying to figure out whether the flow is turbulent or not by calculating the Reynolds number. And here's a case where we're applying Stokes' law, right? So Stokes' law says that the force is 6 pi r viscosity radius times velocity. And they tell us what the force is, they tell us the velocity, they tell us the radius, and they want us to calculate the viscosity. So they've told us everything except one variable in Stokes' law. Good to go. I bet there's still pizza in the room between the lab rooms. Say again? Yes, you should take it home. Should I bring it back? You can if you want. I'm not going to grade it.